Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll learn more about some recent historic preservation awards in Central Ohio. Jay Fox will also speak with the head of a nonprofit that supports pediatric cancer research and with an author who wrote a book about how war shapes the brain. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
It's a great year to be a Buckeye, especially if you're into historic preservation like I am. This year, Ohio History Connection is recognizing 14, that's right, count them, 14 outstanding historic preservation achievements throughout the Buckeye State. Diana Welling is the State Historic Preservation Officer and also the Director of the State Historic Preservation Office, and she joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome, Diana, and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure. So let's start at the beginning for people who may not know. What is the importance and the history behind the State Historic Preservation Office Awards?
So sure. These awards have actually been around since 1983, so for more than 40 years. Over that time, they've become one of the most meaningful ways Ohio recognizes leadership, innovation, and commitment in historic preservation. That longevity also reflects Ohio's deep and ongoing investment in protecting its historic places.
Now, here in Columbus, Ohio, we are very proud of our German village, which, if I'm not mistaken, was one of the country's biggest historic preservation projects at its time.
Yes, that's correct, and one of the earliest historic districts.
So what qualifies as a historic renovation project and then, as you said, a historic district?
So in terms of the awards, we have two main categories our awards are given in, so preservation merit and public education and awareness. Preservation merit awards recognize high-quality preservation work, for example, rehabilitating historic buildings, restoring landscapes, or protecting cemeteries and archaeological sites. Our public education and awareness awards highlight projects that help people better understand and connect with history, such as exhibits, documentaries, publications, or community programs, but together they show that preservation is both about places and people.
Is 14 the largest number of awards the state has won?
As far as I know, it actually is. So we had a lot of amazing projects to choose from this year. So yeah, we had 14 award winners in 2025.
Well, let's start in Central Ohio, which is where we are right now. What
sure.
Central Ohio projects got the nod?
Well, I would say for Central Ohio, I'm going to recognize the Newark Arcade and the Newark Development Partners. The 1909 Newark Arcade was brought back from severe decline, restoring its hidden historic features, creating loft apartments, retail, and a home for a winter farmer's market. So it's a preservation as downtown renewal.
And outside of Newark, where else in Central Ohio do we have pride?
I'm trying to think what other Central Ohio projects we had specifically. We had quite a few in the Cincinnati area. We also had some down in Portsmouth, in Dayton. The Dayton Arcade as well was recognized. So all over the state, really, we had a lot of amazing projects.
There's,
all the way down to Portsmouth.
There seems to be a trend in our major cities, and now it's getting into some of our medium-sized cities in the state, to take historic buildings that may have had another purpose, like retail or an office building, and turn them into living space. Is this a tradition that will continue, and does it come with historic preservation funds that make the renovations possible?
For sure. I mean, absolutely. We have a lot of places, especially in our downtown or more urban areas, that were historically office space that are being turned into apartments and living spaces. Ideally, a lot of those projects are using the historic tax credits. We have both state and federal historic tax credits that people can take advantage of to help fund their projects.
When you think about some of the other projects that were acknowledged in the 14, give us a couple of examples of some other projects outside of the Central and Southern Ohio region that we can plan our travels to go see.
For sure. So I would say in Portsmouth, the Friends of the Green Lawn Cemetery Foundation, it's an amazing cemetery down in Portsmouth. They led the restoration of a 150-year-old zinc Union soldier statue that watches over more than 360 veterans' graves. It was a completely volunteer-driven project rooted in respect and local pride down there. Also, one of our other awards was for Urbanist Media, partnered with Cincinnati Public Radio on Juneteenth Cincinnati Shorts, which is their 90-second audio stories that bring Black Cincinnati history to life through, you know, rich storytelling and careful research.
Now, the city of Marietta itself is kind of like our Williamsburg. Talk to me a little bit about how the state of Ohio has poured so much money into keeping that in the tradition that it's been since it, you know, first was established.
For sure. I mean, Marietta has some of our most significant landmarks and resources in that area. And, you know, a lot of investment is put down in that part of our state. So, I mean, there's a lot of great things going on in Cincinnati, including the new Ohio River Museum that's being built down there by the Ohio History Connection.
So what does it mean for communities, whether it's Marietta, Portsmouth, Newark, Cincinnati, what does it mean for these communities to receive this type of recognition?
I think receiving this award is a meaningful validation of hard work and, you know, often takes years, sometimes decades, right, to bring these projects together. And it brings visibility to a project or an organization. I think it also helps build momentum for future preservation efforts when people see the success and often inspires others to take on similar work. So for many communities, I think it's also a moment of pride, a signal that their history matters and that their efforts are really making a difference statewide.
When I think back on my almost 60 years of life as an Ohioan, I think about so many of the historic properties that were lost in Cleveland and Akron and Canton and Toledo and Columbus and other places. Why did it take so long for historic preservation to reach this level of priority?
I mean, I think it really kind of started, you know, with the National Historic Preservation Act, which was in 1966. That was sort of a direct reaction to what was going on with urban renewal projects. Like, I'm sitting here right now at the Ohio History Center looking at Interstate 71 that goes in front of the History Center. And that project, actually, when they built the freeway, you know, really divided a neighborhood in two and destroyed, you know, so many historic properties along the way. And so I think all across our country, there was a lot of outrage over what happened during our urban renewal, you know, decade. And out of that, President Johnson signed the National Historic Preservation Act. And out of that, you know, was the National Register of Historic Places was created, you know, later on federal historic tax credits. So I think it's been going on almost 60 years now, right? Next year will be the 60th anniversary of the National Historic Preservation Act. And we've had, you know, ups and downs like any other movement. But I do think for the most part, when you talk about historic preservation, whether you're talking with communities or legislators, it's something almost everybody can get behind. And it's really a bipartisan thing for most people.
What are you most excited about for 2026?
Well, so, I mean, we have a lot of exciting things coming up. America 250 in 2026. There's going to be a lot of activities around that celebration. We also will be celebrating every other year. We have a program here called the Ohio Open Doors, which is all over Ohio, really, and the opportunity for places that typically aren't open to the public to open to the public during that time. It's the dates of that are going to be September 10th to the 20th of 2026. And our our goal this year is to have an event in all 88 counties, 250 events in all 88 counties. So it's a lofty goal, but we're working hard to make sure that that happens and that there are places open all over our state for people to visit and to celebrate America 250.
Now, if memory serves me correctly, your building also underwent a renovation recently. Is that true?
The Ohio History Center?
Yeah.
So actually right now there is work going on in the Ohio Village. That work is actually ongoing. And the Ohio History Center, that is kind of the next step in a project we're calling Campus 2.0. So the Village will be first, and then work will begin on the Ohio History Center, hopefully in the next couple of years. Our building is also listed on the National Register of Historic Places, along with the Village. So, hoping for exciting things in the future for both the Village and the Ohio History Center.
Well, we want to thank Diana Welling for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Here in Columbus, an organization called Cancer Free Kids has presented a check to Nationwide Children's Hospital in the amount of $650,000 for cancer research. Drew Dalmuch is the Columbus Marketing, or I should say Columbus Market Managing Director. That's a lot of alliteration for anxious anchors. And he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
Let's start at the beginning. Drew, what is Cancer Free Kids?
Well, Cancer Free Kids is a nonprofit that's dedicated to the eradication of cancer as a life-threatening disease in children, and that's really manifests in two ways. It's creating cures for the cancer itself, but also seeking drugs that are less toxic. One of the issues with pediatric cancer is that even when the treatment is successful, the drugs that we have are so toxic that it presents chronic healthcare concerns for the children later on in life. So we are really focused on creating treatment pathways that eliminate both of those.
How long has the program been in existence, Drew?
We've been around since 2002, so 23 years, and we are based out of Cincinnati, and that's largely where our experience is, but we are trying to increase our presence here in the Columbus market, and regardless of that, our funding over the last 5 to 6 years has been about 50-50 between Columbus Children's, Nationwide Children's Hospital and Cincinnati Children's Hospital, which are two of the top five pediatric oncology cancer in the entire country.
That's exactly right. Now, specifically, what will the $650,000 donation fund?
So we are really in the spot. You mentioned, our history. Our founder, Ellen Flannery, her daughter was diagnosed with ocular cancer when she was very young. Ultimately, it's a success story. She's a very successful young woman now. Everything's okay. But when Ellen was looking around to find where she could potentially make an impact, talked to a lot of different research scientists around the country, and the area of need was this early stage research funding. So essentially, proof of concept, really truly innovative, disruptive ideas that otherwise would not receive funding. So in the clinical trial process, in order to get yourself in a position to be able to receive government dollars, private equity dollars, you really need to prove that your idea is worthwhile. And that's the space that we play in. So we give two different types of awards, what we call our New Idea Award, which is what I was just describing. So again, those truly innovative and disruptive ideas, and we fund that, and then we have what is called our Accelerator Award. So New Idea Awards that have proven to be viable, we then reinvest dollars into that to help them continue that work, again, to get them to the point where they can receive ancillary funding. So with that, over the course of our history, we've seeded $12.5 million in those New Idea and Accelerator funds, grants, and that's gone on to an additional $114 million in government grant dollars, and an additional $165 million in private equity. So pharmaceutical companies that are coming in investing in these ideas. And so a tremendous return on investment for what we are investing in. We have a very esteemed scientific review council, so an independent scientific review council from that consists of research scientists across the country. They're reviewing all of these applications and making a determination on what we think can have the most impact on children ultimately, and those are the ideas that we fund.
How long does it take for an idea to become reality and receive FDA approval?
It's a great question. It is unfortunately a long process. Obviously, it needs to be done in a safe way, especially when we're talking about children. So it can be a number of years. It can be as short as 18 to 24 months. It really just depends on that specific idea. But it is a long runway, and we are doing everything that we can to help accelerate that. One of the other issues is that this pediatric cancer is severely underfunded at the national level. So. Children that receive a cancer diagnosis, unfortunately, one in six of those children will not survive. And unfortunately, there's no profit motive from a private industry standpoint to heavily invest in pediatric oncology. So as a result, we have 700 drugs that are approved for use in adult oncology diagnosis, and only 63 are there to treat children. So. Only 8% of the federal cancer budget goes towards treating kids, and certainly more dollars in that space would help accelerate that transition pathway.
What would you say is the most difficult type of cancer to treat in children?
I think that they all have their difficulties. I think one of the great things about a lot of the grants that we fund is that they have applicability across disease site diagnosis. So while they might be focused initially on one specific disease, a lot of them are able to be utilized across different cancer diagnoses. I think all of them are difficult. And we're trying to address all of them the best that we can.
How does a hospital and or a caregiver keep these children positive through treatment? Because studies have shown that the more positive the attitude is in a cancer patient, the greater the likelihood that they will not only survive but thrive.
I think that's a great question. I think, again, the two hospitals that we partner with, Nationwide Children's and Cincinnati Children's, do a fantastic job of creating an environment for the children where they can heal. So the facilities, being light and fun, and but then also, the biggest part is obviously the staff that are interacting with the children on a daily basis, and they're able to become friends with them and help them through this process. But then I think the other piece of that is giving them hope, and that's the space that Cancer Free Kids plays in, and giving them hope that there's light at the end of the tunnel, and that this is something that can be overcome. And there's a community that develops amongst the kids themselves, and they go through this together, and they see successes. And I think that sort of creates a positive environment for them to heal.
Now, I'm a parent, and I knock on wood that my children have never had to face such an extreme illness. And I'm sure that many other parents are listening to this broadcast right now, and they're probably asking the same question I'm going to ask of you. What can we do to help, given that pediatric oncology is such a surprisingly low priority?
Well, certainly you can get involved with Cancer Free Kids. You can go to our website, which is cancerfreekids.org. There will be many different options laid out for you there on how to become involved financially, how to give your time, your energy, and lots of different information on our events there. I think that is a great way to reinvest your time, your resources into helping cure this awful disease.
In 2026, what's your biggest challenge, Drew?
Our biggest challenge is, of course, continuing to generate the dollars needed to invest in this very important research, but helping to offset some of the uncertainty on government funding dollars. Our applications for grants this year almost doubled because there is some uncertainty around traditional dollars that have been provided for research. So I think our biggest challenge is continuing to help fill that gap and to continue generating awareness and momentum for us here in the Columbus market, as we are, as I was explaining, we are new to the market and trying to help people understand what it is that Kansas Free does, why we do it, and why it's so important, which is why I appreciate you having me on this morning.
Well, and we appreciate you being with us. We want to thank Drew Dalmich, who is the Columbus Market Managing Director for Cancer Free Kids. And we also want to thank Cancer Free Kids for their generous donation to our nationwide Children's Hospital for Cancer Research. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox. Thanks for listening.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Today, we're going to talk about war, specifically how the brain shapes war and how war shapes the brain. Nicholas Wright is a neuroscientist who researches the brain, technology, and security, and serves as an advisor to the Pentagon, among other concerns. He has a spectacular new book out called Warhead, and he joins us right now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning, sir.
Jay, thank you so much for having me on.
It was a marvelous read. I enjoyed every minute of it.
Thank you.
We have so many veterans living here in Columbus and Central Ohio, I'm sure they will find this fascinating. But in a sentence or two, in your own words, what would you say the book is about and what motivated you to write it?
I mean, what motivated me is that we've learned a huge amount about how the brain works, and we need to understand that now, because the central weapon of war will always be the human brain. And right now, the democracies, the United States, the United Kingdom, allies, you know, we could lose a major conflict. We need to understand why humans fight so we can reduce the chances of what really could be another world war. And we need to understand ourselves so that if we must fight, we can win.
In your book, you assert that human beings are biologically built for conflict due to our primal makeup and biology. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, so there isn't one simple thing that drives us towards conflict. So the book is a journey through the brain, starting at the brainstem right down at the base, and then going up step by step to the very other end of the brain, which is called the frontal pole, and that can do some of our most sophisticated things, like thinking about our own thinking. Now, there's not one reason, there's not one simple thing about our brain that drives us towards conflict. There are many things. I'll give you an example right from sort of quite deep in the brain, which is fear. And a region called the amygdala is really important for fear. Now, very occasionally, people can lose the amygdala. It's a rare condition, but it can happen. They lose this little part of the brain that's very important for fear. When that happens, they can lose the ability to see fear in others and lose the feeling of fear themselves. They don't feel fear. But that doesn't turn those people into ruthless criminals who can take whatever they want whenever they want it. They don't become fearless criminals. They instead often become victims of crime, because we need fear. Fear is useful, right? It helps us survive and navigate our societies. And yet, when two groups of people, for example, both fear each other, that can lead to spirals of conflict. And there are so many other reasons throughout the brain that can drive us towards conflict. But just as I don't want to be pessimistic, I want to be optimistic, because actually we can understand that like never before. And if we understand why humans fight, then we can reduce the chances of fighting.
Now, obviously, the brain is the body's supercomputer, but fatigue, hunger, and other sensory deprivation situations can cause humans to make bad choices in high-stakes situations. Having read up on wartime prisoner interrogation techniques, is this what you were referring to?
Well, that is do you know what? It's really interesting. So the way that things like hunger and thirst and sleep deprivation affect human beings is often quite counterintuitive. So interestingly, hunger and thirst, for example, they will cause humans to do, you know, almost anything to get food. So there were, for example, Russian prisoners in the Second World War who would basically essentially be shot because they just couldn't take the hunger any longer. But interestingly, what happens when we're hungry or thirsty is that although it makes us feel miserable, it doesn't actually reduce our ability to solve problems. right? Whereas sleep deprivation, on the other hand, so we know that if you, for example, sleep deprivise rodents, that they will die after, say, about a month or so, right? But actually, sleep deprivation in humans, interestingly, we feel like it doesn't have much of an effect on our cognitive abilities. But actually, when you're sleep deprived, you have little micro sleeps, you miss entire responses to things that are happening in the world, and it actually really can really make our performance deteriorate.
Now, how has the brain function played a role in some of our most important military conflicts? And I'm talking like the Korean War and Douglas MacArthur. A lot of people said, you know, his choices represented gross insubordination and caused him to be removed. But others said it was because of issues regarding the brain.
Yeah, I mean, Douglas MacArthur was very successful. He was a general. He was very successful in World War II in the Pacific War. And he was taken by surprise by the North Korean invasion of South Korea in 1950. But he then himself, right, did a brilliant maneuver which used surprise. Surprise will always be a key factor in war. It's an absolutely central factor in war. And that's because of human brains. Surprise has really big impacts on human brains. And MacArthur had these inch-on landings, enabled him to surprise the enemy and so on. Now, unfortunately, what he then did is he went too far. He did not have restraint, and that's something we also need. We need wisdom. This is the kind of thing that people have where they can reflect on their own thinking, they can calibrate their self-confidence. And what MacArthur didn't have was he didn't have well-calibrated self-confidence, unlike his contemporary Eisenhower, for example, who went on to become president, obviously. And so MacArthur, he did not calibrate his self-confidence. The Chinese attacked. They drove him all the way back. He insisted on using nuclear weapons. He did not listen to what the Joint Chiefs of Staff were telling him. In the words of one of them, he just didn't listen to the orders, right? And in the end, he actually, because of his lack of moderation, his lack of self-control, his lack of wisdom, he was beaten militarily into a stalemate, and then ultimately, through military failure, he was removed and ceased to be the commander of U.S. forces in Korea.
Absolutely. Now, in your book, you refer to the will to fight and how that may supersede overwhelming factors during wartime. What creates the will to fight, and conversely, what causes that will to collapse, as we saw with the French in 1940?
Yeah, I mean, there is never going to be a complete answer to that question, because it is there's always going to be an element of luck, of chance in there. But we know a lot of the key factors, and it can make a huge difference. So your brain is, and my brain, the brain of every listener, it's not like one single simple system. It is like an orchestra. You have an orchestra of brain systems that work together. Now, some of the really key systems are to do with things like fear. And a lot of the will to fight is about being able to master your fear, so that instead of fear leading you to just freeze or run away, which is what happened to sort of the poorly trained French troops in May 1940 when they were catastrophically defeated by the Germans. Instead, you can turn that, you can respond to that fear appropriately, right? And you can attack, you can take much more appropriate responses. Now, a lot of that's down to training. So, for example, the Germans spent the 8 months of what became known as the Phony War, when not a lot was happening on the Western Front. They spent that 8 months furiously training. Instead, the French barely trained at all. And, for example, Jean-Paul Sartre, who was a writer, he was in the French army, and he was able to write part of a couple of big volumes of work. Now, in addition to that, the Germans also had brilliant, absolutely brilliant command and facilities for communicating within their army, and that enabled them to do the Blitzkrieg, which caused enormous surprise in the French, and that helped smash their will to fight. And it's really, you know, we have to remember that this can happen if we don't train properly and we are unprepared for the realities of the world as it actually is, and that can be a world in which the other side actually fights brilliantly, and we will be initially defeated, but we have to keep on fighting. And of course, that is what a lot of the Allies did, and that's why eventually we did win World War II.
Let's bring it back to present day. I would be remiss if I did not ask about AI. How will future conflicts be fought by or perhaps enhanced by AI?
I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, this, I've been working on AI issues with the Pentagon for, you know, over a decade now. So let me give you a couple of, like, one key example, which is that what we're going to have is already now, a few weeks ago, were the very first ever public announcements that there were swarms of drones. And those swarms of drones were given an order by a commander in Ukraine who said, apply this lethal force to this target. And the swarm of drones then worked out how it was going to conduct that. Now, those swarms of drones, that's the very first time that's been announced in public. Those swarms of drones are just the start. If there was a war, for example, between China and the United States, which are massively more powerful technological actors than Ukraine, then what you're going to have is you will have huge amounts of swarm-on-swarm action. And it will be like dueling technologists, right? A bit like the Battle of Britain, which was the RAF versus the Luftwaffe, right? Just a few hundred pilots on each side, and they will be enormously important. And these pilots today will be piloting swarms of drones. And what will be crucial is how the humans can control those drones, how they can communicate with those swarms of drones. And that will be understanding the humans every single bit as much as the drones that they'll be controlling.
Do you have time for one more question?
I would love to. I'd love another question. These are brilliant questions.
You refer to introspection and self-knowledge as being the key to empowering the individual to navigate the complex and ever-changing world today. Should we all be in therapy? And if not, what can we do to enhance our self-knowledge?
Do you know what? Well, I would say you could read the book. But we shouldn't all be in therapy. And in fact, I think there's a bit too much discussion of mental health and therapy. We actually often don't need to, turn these things into pathologies. Humans are enormously more resilient than we give ourselves credit for. So instead, I think what we need to do is remember what wisdom is, right? We need to look for wisdom. And so I describe in the book a lot of ways that we can make wiser choices. One of those, exactly as you say, is introspection, thinking about our own thinking. We know so much about how that happens in a region involving what's called the frontal pole, a bit just behind your forehead. Really, that's the most distinctively human part of the brain. And that metacognition, that thinking about thinking, helps us know ourselves better. And that has been central to wisdom from the days of, ancient Greece or ancient Chinese philosophers. And now what we can do is we can say, practical ways that everyone of us can make that better. It can be enhanced within us. For example, by taking a third person perspective. For example, by having, as Winston Churchill did, people around us who aren't yes men, but will challenge us, right? They will ask us difficult questions. And that's deliberately what Churchill had around him, people who would challenge him and ask him difficult questions. There are many practical ways that we can make wiser choices, and we will need that kind of wisdom as we face a range of challenges, moving forwards, all of which matter. That's losing domestically. You don't want American democracy to collapse and decay, or American freedom. You don't want to lose a conventional war, because that would be catastrophic, right, for a wide variety of reasons, in East Asia and then perhaps even into the Americas, in South America. And you do not want to lose a nuclear war, because you don't even want to fight a nuclear war. Because if 60 or 80 or 100 million Chinese people die and the same number of Americans die, in any meaningful sense, that's a catastrophic loss for the United States. So we need to be wiser and balance these different ways that we can lose in our time. And I'm optimistic we can do it. We can make wiser choices. People like Eisenhower thought about this so carefully. For example, President Eisenhower, we can make wiser choices in our time. And I'm optimistic and confident we can do that.
The book is called Warhead. The author is Nicholas Wright. It is available wherever books are sold. And we thank you so much for joining us today. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan, Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
We start today with a focus on U.S. involvement in Venezuela. The main headlines surrounding Venezuela now have to do with oil seizures, and oil sales. I talked with Bowling Green State University political science professor Dr. Nicole Califf-Hughes for perspective on U.S. involvement in Venezuela over the years and how it got to where it is today. She says it dates back decades with Venezuela's oil industry and the changing of leadership of the country. Professor Califf-Hughes and I talked about that, what's happening now, and what comes next.
When you hear discussion today about, like, taking back what's ours refers to international companies like Exxon taking back essentially the investment that they lost in Venezuela when Venezuela nationalized the oil industry. Venezuela nationalizes the oil industry in the late 90s, early 2000s. They start using all that money to support the population, which is great as long as the money keeps coming in and oil prices stay high. When oil prices dip, you lose that money, you lose that resource, and there's nothing else to take its place. And you combine that with leaders of Venezuela bringing in not experts so much as their friends, and you end up with a lot of corruption, a lot of economic uncertainty, and a lot of poverty for everyone in Venezuela, with the exception of the elite ruling class. And that's essentially how kind of we got to this point. Venezuela and the U.S. have kind of feuded over this for a really long time, because a lot of these companies are American companies that lost some of their investment when Venezuela nationalized the oil industry. And as the economy crumbled, you started having more opportunistic political leaders step in. And that's kind of where we are right now. Maduro took over from Chavez, again, runs on this idea of keeping profits in Venezuela, and was not successful at keeping the economy stable.
So was this about oil and not about a law enforcement thing with, you know, drugs and weapons that they arrested Maduro for?
Well, there is indeed an indictment for Maduro focusing on drugs, and we'll have to see how that plays out in the courts, right? An indictment isn't necessarily an indicator of guilt. He'll have to go through a trial in the regular American legal process. But based on everything that's happened since the arrest of Maduro and his wife, it's oil. It all goes back to oil, and it's kind of like the same old song with a slightly different tune. Everything the U.S. has done since his capture doesn't really have anything to do with stemming flows of drugs, because there's very little evidence from U.S. intelligence that Maduro had anything to do with large-scale drug trafficking. It's oil. It's always oil. And we tend to really focus on that throughout history, at least in the recent past.
Leaders I've talked to here in the U.S. have said that the proceeds from the Venezuelan oil will be used to benefit the Venezuelan people. Is that how you see it playing out?
We don't know. And so you've seen President Trump has posted on social media that he's like the acting president of Venezuela and comments to that effect, which isn't necessarily true. Marco Rubio has tried to kind of walk those back and said that we're actually going to be in charge of Venezuelan oil and oil profits, and we will use that to better the situation in Venezuela for Venezuelans. We don't know how that's going to play out. We don't have an infrastructure for that. We don't necessarily have a way to set that up yet. And they could come up with something, but how do you get there? How do you get that money back to the people? Because right now, the way Venezuela is set up and has been set up, the people who are benefiting from any oil revenue are the elites. It is not going down to the average Venezuelan. It's not going down to the public in really any meaningful way. It's not improving schools or healthcare or anything like that. So we don't necessarily have a way to do that. And because the government that is in power is essentially Maduro's government, it's his vice president is in charge. We don't really have any clear plans for those changes yet that have come out. We can say this, but it's a lot easier to say we're going to do it than actually act on it. The other problem with that is actually the cost of oil. Oil is not super high right now. It's not tremendously expensive. And Trump actually campaigned on lowering the price of oil. So if you lower the price of oil, that's actually less money to send back to Venezuela. And that's not even touching on the infrastructure to actually extract the oil in Venezuela, which is a whole separate can of worms.
You mentioned that Maduro's vice president is now running is in charge of the government there. But the United States has talked about us running Venezuela. What is happening? Is there a power vacuum and the stability or instability right now in the country?
I would say it's instability. I think you could argue that there is a power vacuum. There have long been different competing factions in Venezuela, with the opposition party that broadly it's agreed actually won the last presidential election, and Maduro just said no and stayed president. There's been a lot of competing factions in Venezuela. There are armed groups in Venezuela. The situation has been very unstable there for a long time. And us, as in America, running Venezuela is mostly us expressing our preferences and kind of threatening the use of military force, but we don't have a clear structure for that to happen. Everyone in power in Venezuela right now is still Maduro's government. And so there's not, we can threaten, but we don't have like a clear lever of government to make those types of changes.
What's the political fallout here?
After January 3rd, when we took Maduro and his wife, Republican support for military intervention in Venezuela went way up. Democrats still stayed pretty low, right around 13%. Republicans went up to about 70%. But the average American, if you're looking at the aggregate, does not really support military intervention in Venezuela.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM, The Fan 2.